About disabling the environment for sex trafficking by decreasing demand. And I just met Brad about 30 seconds ago, and he's got an amazing bio here, and I said, you know, they don't want to hear from me, and you guys can read the bio, but essentially he is the executive director, CEO of the Polaris Project, and it just sounds like it's this, he tries to encompass all areas of this issue and address it on all different levels. And so he pointed out the most important thing right now maybe is the Polaris Project's operation of the National Human Trafficking Resource Center hotline. So, but I don't want to spend any more time, and I'm just going to introduce him right now, and let's give him a warm welcome. Thank you.
All righty. Well, for those of you who haven't been in one of these sessions before, nice to meet you. And for those of you who are in the previous sessions, I'm sorry you're hearing so much of me. Betty Ann and them were like, if you're going to fly into town from D.C., we're going to put you to work from every moment of the day, and we're going to put you at every breakout. So get ready to talk for 9 straight hours. And so I'm just going. And so for some of you, this might be new and haven't met before. For others, we've been in sessions together before, so good to see you again. Trying to keep the 3 sessions, or the 4 sessions that I'm doing, totally distinct. So the plenary one this morning with John sitting on those stools talked about a few things. Then there was a session on the national hotline. We just got finished with a session on state policy, and now this session focuses on demand. So I have a few kind of general overall points that I'd like to share just to give us all a baseline to start a discussion. And then from there, I want to open it up for questions. So I'd really like to hear from you all, especially in the area of addressing demand. This is an area that the field is, should we shut that, do y'all think? So this is an area that the field is very, very new at. And so there isn't a feeling of everything's already been tried, everything's down to a science. Really, we're at a point where everybody's ideas, opinions are totally at the stage where we need those ideas and opinions. We need folks to be giving their best thinking. And all the things that David Batstone said about we need more of you and we need people to create new models, that's exactly where we are in the fight against demand. So I'll start there. So let's talk about a few different types of demand, right? So a couple caveats that I want to start with. First, this session is only talking about sex trafficking. So we're not talking about the whole side of demand for products made with slavery or whatever else. Why we buy these shoes or this Hanes undershirt or whatever else, that's a different type of demand. Right now, we're only talking about the demand for sex. So want to start that off because I don't want folks to think that this is a biased discussion. It really is only a discussion about sex trafficking, so it's only one part. The second thing that I want to start off with saying is that there are all different parts of the sex industry where people are buying sex. And it's very hard to lump it all into one homogenous category. And what I would really emphasize folks to understand is that when you're talking about demand, you need to realize how heterogeneous it is, okay? I'll give you a few examples. Let's start off with street prostitution, okay? The woman in street prostitution, why is she there? Maybe she's there because she's independently operating. And you could say, quote unquote, voluntary. And she doesn't have a pimp. She doesn't have a drug problem. She needs some money for whatever reason, and she's prostituting herself on the street, okay? Maybe she's there because she does have a pimp, and the pimp is forcing her out and saying, you have to go out in street prostitution or else this is going to happen to you. Maybe she's there because she's a drug addict and she needs to make money for drugs or whatever else. So there's all these different reasons, right? So you have these men who are buying sex from this particular market, and they're driving around in their cars or walking on foot, and trying to purchase her in street prostitution for various prices, various lengths of time, whatever else. Demographics of the men widely vary. Ages of the men widely vary. Socioeconomic status of the men widely vary. Safety levels and intentions of the men widely vary. But you have this notion of, quote unquote, an open network where street prostitution doesn't necessarily restrict itself to only one type of John or another type of John. It's really anyone who pulls up in their car, okay? So there's one network. Another network, let's switch gears. Brothels that exist indoors but disguise themselves as legitimate massage parlors. So they try to claim to be a legitimate massage parlor when really they're not trying to give any sort of massage. And any sort of massage posters on the wall are all just a front. And any sort of like massage table and exercise bike in the lobby are also just a front and not even plugged in and gathering dust. It's just a total front because you're trying to make it look like you're a legitimate business when really all you're trying to do is sell sex. And so the men who go to these massage parlors, they are usually a specific demographic because the price of the commercial sex is generally higher. It's usually about $60 to $160 for an hour. And so the men who are going to that network are men who can afford $60 to $160 for an hour of commercial sex. So they tend to be more middle to upper class, professional men, often Caucasian. And they tend to be computer literate. So these particular Johns spend a lot of time communicating with each other online. And they'll say, hey, you know, I just created a Google map of every massage parlor in the city. Or, hey, I just, you know, went to this one Asian massage parlor. I was with this woman named Sunny, and let me tell you about my experience with Sunny. So there are these things online called John boards. And John boards are discussion forums online distinctly for Johns to communicate with each other and share information with each other and kind of build community and camaraderie amongst each other because these guys feel lonely, they're out buying sex, and they want to feel validated by other guys who are buying sex. So they've launched these John boards, and they kind of talk to each other, and it's like a discussion board. And so there's hundreds of these John boards around the country. One of the biggest ones is the USA Sex Guide. The website's usasexguide.info. Guide, usasexguide.info. So there are these John boards, and the Johns who buy sex from the massage parlors heavily use the John boards. So when they get done having sex in the massage parlor, they'll go home and they'll write about it online. And the John boards get really, really explicit. They'll rate the woman on a scale of 1 to 10 for all these different features. 1, looks. 2, breast size. 3, her attitude during sex. 4, how smiley and moaning she was and whatever else. 5, how good she was at oral sex and different things like that. And they'll rate amongst each other. And so you have these John boards kind of like feeding each other's tendency. And they call themselves hobbyists, where it is actually their hobby to buy sex from people. So you have John boards, you have this one demographic of guys who are buying sex from these Asian massage parlors. Let's switch gears to a total different type of network. Asian residential brothels that are based out of certain homes, where to get into that brothel, you have to be a man of a certain type of ethnicity, and you are not allowed in if you're not. And so they keep it, quote unquote, closed to a certain ethnicity because the brothel is trying to, quote unquote, keep it within the family. And they feel like culturally these guys are going to understand better. Culturally they're not going to judge us. Culturally there's not any cultural relativism going on. They get why these women are in prostitution. So there are certain types of sex networks that are open to any John that wants to buy sex. And there are other types of sex networks that are limited to certain ethnicities of Johns who want to buy sex, which is interesting, right? Because the brothel is trying to inoculate itself or protect itself against law enforcement. And they think by only letting certain types of Johns have sex with them, that will limit law enforcement's involvement. So you have to understand these closed networks versus these open networks. You have to understand these John boards and all these different things, okay? Another type of network, Latino residential brothels. There's a whole type of sex network where there are these brothels being launched out of homes. And unlike the Asian massage parlors, they don't try to be a legitimate business. They don't try to register with the state. They don't try to get a business occupancy permit. They don't try to advertise in the yellow pages. They don't try to have a tax ID. They don't try to do any of that. They just open a little underground brothel out of a house and start advertising to Johns and say, hey, come over to this house, have sex with a woman, pay cash, and leave. And so it's a cash-based business. And there are these Latino brothels that are popping up all over the country. In D.C., there's about 20 of them. In Northern Virginia, there's more. And the Latino brothels are also a closed network where they are only restricted to Latino Johns. And sometimes they make the John prove that he's first generation. Sometimes they test his Spanish skills. All these different things. And the brothels have a specific pricing structure, which is $30 for 15 minutes of sex with one of the women. So what you'll see, there's a really interesting book that a gentleman by the name of Siddharth Kara wrote, and it might be here in the resources section, but it talks about the business of sex trafficking. And he went around the world, and he talked to Johns, and he tried to compute a global average of how much money, on average, a man would be willing to pay for sex with somebody else. And what he was able to find out, and I think some other studies corroborated this, was that if a man is willing to pay for sex, the amount of money he's generally willing to pay is 2.5 times his hourly wage. So if you're a guy that's making $100 an hour, you'll pay $250 for an hour of sex. That's your price point. But if you're a guy who's making $10 an hour, the most you'd ever pay for sex is $25. And so the different commercial sex networks are changing their prices based on their clientele. And so they're kind of saying, okay, if we're trying to cater to the population of men who make $10 an hour, and these guys are only going to pay $25 max for sex, we'll charge them $30. But if we charge anything more than $30, our business is going to be just empty because no guy's going to come, right? So then there are other places that have different pricing structures. So you have to understand that the commercial sex network itself and the broader commercial sex trade is extremely heterogeneous. And there are even certain commercial sex networks that cater, quote unquote, to high-end customers, like the Elliott Spitzer $10,000 for a weekend type thing, right? So Johns, it's very, very hard to box Johns into a homogenous conversation because it's just not the reality. There's so many different subsections. There's a great book out on Johns called The Johns, and it's written by this kind of fast, kind of very quick-witted, very witty Canadian broadcast journalist named Victor Malarek. And he wrote a book called The Johns. And he went around the world interviewing Johns, and he spent a lot of time on these John boards learning about Johns, and he tried to really kind of get inside the mind of a John. And he talks about how distinct all these different populations of Johns are. And there are so many different reasons why men seek to buy sex. There are some guys who buy sex because they're lonely and don't have any romantic relationship in their life. There are some guys who buy sex because they demand increasingly edgy and kind of kinky sex acts that their wife or girlfriend is not willing to do, like anal sex or something like that. And as long as their wife or girlfriend's not willing to do it, they'll go out and seek it to pay for it. There are some guys who buy sex because they're sadistic and they want to inflict pain on someone. There's all these different reasons. And Shively, in his book, The Johns, walks through all of this, right? So you have some of these foundational concepts that I want to put out there for you to understand. One, all these different types of sex networks and how the Johns are so different. Two, the pricing structures and how much the pricing structures are. Three, the closed network and the open network, and do you restrict the John or not sort of thing. Four, the notion of John boards and how Johns communicate with each other and how kind of twisted and bizarre that is. And it's important to understand all of these things to begin having this conversation. How are y'all doing on heat? It's hot. Maybe we should open this door. Even though it was loud earlier, let's deal with the noise and get some. Maybe we could try to get the AC going. I'm going to take questions in a little while. Okay, so foundational concept so far. Y'all generally good with that, and y'all generally following me so far. Okay, couple other points that I want to make about some of these things. There isn't entire agreement in the field that we should even be talking about Johns. And I want to put that out there because I've been in enough discussions with people that inevitably reveals the differences of opinion in the room. And my guess is those differences of opinion exist in this room, where there are some people who believe that Johns and people willing to pay for sex are creating a market for sex. And traffickers respond to wherever that market is. So if there were a community that had zero people buying sex, like, I don't know, where would a community be where zero people buy sex? Utah, I don't know, the Amish, who knows? A convent of nuns. Are there any traffickers trying to sell sex at a convent of nuns? Probably not, right? So traffickers respond to where there is a market for sex. So if there's a place where you know there's lots of men buying sex, like Las Vegas or the Super Bowl or San Francisco or whatever else, traffickers respond to where there's a market. And what traffickers are is they are the people that seek to follow the place where there's money to be made selling sex. And they just put women in the sex trade who aren't there voluntarily or children in the sex trade and try to tap into that market. And so some people say, I didn't prepare any PowerPoints because I thought they would kind of distract us, but some people say that let's say the amount of men willing to pay for sex is this high. Okay? And the amount of women who are voluntarily jumping at the chance to sell sex to meet that demand is much lower. So there is a disparity because there's more men willing to pay than there are women willing to sell. And so wherever that gap is between those two bar graphs, so to speak, that's where sex traffickers enter the picture because they say, this market is imbalanced, and there's money being left on the table. There's more consumers than there is product. And so let's put some more product into the equation, which tends to be women who are forced or children. And there is the profit motive to be a sex trafficker. And so in that line of reasoning, people might say, therefore, it is impossible to reduce sex trafficking without talking about men who buy sex. And there's very few men that buy sex specifically saying, I only want to pay for a trafficked woman. The man who wants to buy sex wants to believe that he's buying sex from a voluntary woman who's smiling and moaning and making him feel like the greatest thing in the world and all this stuff. He doesn't want to find out that she's being forced against her will. And so the women in the sex trade are heavily coached to smile and laugh and make him look like you like it, because if he thinks that you're not liking it, he might not come back as a customer. And so the Johns want to believe that lie, right? So in this line of logic, there's a sense that we can work on sex trafficking till we're blue in the face, prosecuting pimps, prosecuting pimps and traffickers, trying to get women out of the sex trade. But as long as there's this huge river of dollars of men willing to pay for all types of sex, both voluntary and not, we're just spinning our wheels because there's always going to be more traffickers seeking to enter that market. So as long as we have thousands of sex tourists going to Cambodia seeking sex with young girls, there's always going to be more people trying to meet that demand. As long as we have hundreds of thousands of men willing to pay for sex at different parts of the country, there's always going to be people willing to meet that demand. And so the notion between sex traffickers and demand is kind of like they come in a pair. And if we really want to say we're going to end sex trafficking, therefore we must say we have to end male demand for prostitution. That's one whole line of logic, okay? And there are some people who really believe that, and some people who really want to fight for that. There are other people who say that if we end all male demand for paying for sex, we are essentially drying up the entire commercial sex market. And there's a number of people in the commercial sex market who are not there as trafficking victims. They're there as quote-unquote sex workers. And they depend on these men buying them for their livelihood. And so if we dry up the customers, we're putting those women out of business. And if we put those women out of business, they will be homeless, hungry, starving, desperate, all those different things. And so we need to have a steady flow of men buying sex so the sex workers can stay in business. And what we should do is we should try to combat trafficking and get all the children out of the sex trade and get all the adults in the sex trade who are forced and coerced and whatever else, get them out of the sex trade. So the only people left in the sex trade are voluntary sex workers. And therefore, if they're the only people left in the sex trade, there's still a male demand of customers to pay for them if it's their choice to be in the sex trade and they see that as empowering for them. Okay? Say that again? I mean, I'm just putting it out there. Like, I don't want to say which one is, you know, how you feel about one way or the other. I'm putting it out there because there's a lot of people who believe both sides. And this... Well, let's get to that in just a second. Let me hold you off for a sec. So this is a really contentious debate. And I want to put it out there and let you all know that this is a really contentious debate. And there are people who have ended their friendships based on this, organizations who can't speak to each other based on this, relationships who've broken up based on this, because they're so passionate about whether or not people in the sex trade are exploited and probably don't want to be there if they had better choices, and probably wouldn't do it voluntarily, and probably are smiling and making it sound like they like it, but don't really. And even if they do, it's such a small subset that it's not representative of the entire sex trade. So we should feel justified in trying to eliminate all male demand and put all women in prostitution, quote unquote, out of business, so that we live in a world where no one is selling themselves for sex. There are some people who really view that. And there are other people over here who really view that we should live in a world where there are voluntary sex workers, but they're able to do it with dignity, and they're able to do it without being stigmatized and safely and with STD checks and have a steady flow of customers that are paying for them, and it's between two consenting adults. And so I want to put that out there as a debate, and I don't want to have that debate today because we'll be sitting here for the next 8 hours debating with each other. But I want to put it out there and say, I want to make it clear that those two different thoughts exist, okay? This whole discussion, if you looked at the description of the session, is tilted towards one of those arguments and not the other. as we're putting it out there. I think it's going to be pretty obvious. So we, in this particular discussion, if you're up for it, and if you agree with it or don't agree with it, If you do agree with it, great. If you don't agree with it, please suspend your disbelief. But what we're trying to do here is talk about this premise of we are actually trying to live in a world where there are zero people selling themselves for sex. And we're trying to live in a world where there's no market for selling sex because, for whatever reason, some people might say, we just want to live in that world because no one should have to sell themselves. Other people might say, we don't want to live in that world because as soon as there's a market for sex, there's always traffickers who enter that market. There will never be a market for selling sex without pimps and traffickers trying to enter that market, ever. And if we believe that, then we believe that we will always have sex trafficking in our world as long as we have men paying for sex. And so to eliminate sex trafficking, we have to eliminate the market of sex. And that is the premise that we're going to kind of try on for the next 45 minutes and kind of talk through that, as if that's the end we're trying to work towards. But we have to go into it with our eyes open, knowing that if we work towards that premise, there might be people who so fundamentally disagree, they're like, how dare you? You're killing sex workers. You're putting them out of business. You're making them, you know, engage in even dirtier and harder and more dangerous types of sex. And you have to own that. And you have to know that if you're going to try to reduce the demand for sex, there's going to be a huge opposition that totally disagrees with you. And so we need to kind of talk that through, okay? So on this premise of this, if this is where we are and we're trying to really reduce the demand for sex, there's a few things that are happening in the field that I want to put out there for you all to be aware of things that people are trying, okay? The things that people are trying are very, very multidisciplinary. Because if you imagine we're trying to reduce the incidence of something that used to be in our world and no longer is in our world anymore, we're trying to abolish it. And think about the times that that happened, right? In Britain, in the 1700s and 1800s, guys used to have the duel, where they walk out in the field and they hold the gun and they shoot at each other. And they had a duel to fight for each other's honor. Then at a certain time in history, the duel just kind of went away. And people don't duel anymore. It's just kind of gone, right? Like, there used to be foot binding in China, where women's feet were 3 inches long and 1 inch wide. And that has largely been reduced. There's these different things that have existed in history that we have abolished. And some people are saying the next thing that we need to abolish is the market of people willing to pay another person for sex with them. And they feel just horrible at the thought of walking up to someone and be like, can I have sex with you? Here's $40. Like, that should never, ever happen in our world. And so if we're going to do that, it's going to take an incredibly comprehensive approach, right? You're not going to be able to just throw everyone in jail and make that change. Or we're not going to be able to just talk to people from a faith perspective and make it change. There's going to have to be so many different prongs happening in tandem, simultaneously, getting at all these different things. And maybe we'll never eliminate it entirely, but we could at least lop it off by 50% or 80% or whatever else, where we make it so marginal that it's really, really kind of random and barely ever exists, okay? So a couple things that are happening out there. One, from the research side, people are trying to start do research on who are the Johns? Why do they buy sex? Who are these guys? Why would they stop? Maybe they would be the first people that we should go to and ask, what would stop you from buying sex? Like, you just bought sex, what would have stopped you? And so people are trying to do this type of research. There's this group down in Atlanta that's researching Johns. There's a group in Chicago that is researching Johns, where they put up an ad up on Craigslist that said, we're looking to interview men who've bought sex at some point in their life. And if you'd like and you're willing to talk about it, come meet us at the Chicago Public Library. We'll pay you $100 for an hour. We'll sit in a private room, and we're going to ask you a bunch of questions about why you bought sex, and we're going to try to figure out what was going on in your head as you were doing it. And so there are folks that are doing this research. And so the field of really understanding why men buy sex and what really goes into that sense of entitlement or whatever else is beginning to occur. There's also research about how many men buy sex, right? Is it 1 in 5? Is it 1 in 10? Is it 1 in 3? Like, we don't know. And do rates in different countries change? So in America, is it 1 in 5? Whereas in Brazil, it's 1 in 2? Like what is that? And so there's a mountain to climb in terms of research and understanding the issue, because right now we're kind of flying blind and we're going in and trying to make these interventions, but we're not really quite sure what works and what doesn't work. And so there's this whole notion of we just need to understand things better. And David talked about smart activism. I think it would be pretty dumb to try to fight against demand and have no idea what Johns are thinking or whatever else. So want to go in and talk to guys and just say, what would have stopped you? So there's one kind of arm of the fight. And so if you're looking for places to plug in or what is your specific niche, do some sort of innovative study on Johns, if you're a researcher or whatever else, and contribute to the body of literature about Johns and be like, we interviewed 100 Latino Johns, and this is what we found. Or we interviewed 100 Johns who buy sex at Asian massage parlors, and this is what we found. Or whatever else. You know, that's some interesting research that needs to be done. So there's a research front that's happening. There's another front that's happening, which is the online front. Because a lot of the sex trade has moved online. And the two biggest websites where most of the sex ads exist in America, one used to be Craigslist, and the second is this website called Backpage.com. And if you go to Backpage, Backpage is just like Craigslist. It's an online classified site. And there's all these different, you know, rent an apartment, find a tennis partner, there's all this stuff. And then Backpage has this whole adult section. And one of the adult section is adult escorts. And that section is where a lot of people go to post ads to sell sex, and that's where a lot of Johns go to buy sex. And most Johns, I think, if you know, you pull into town, you're on a business trip, you're in Pasadena, California, you don't know anybody, you're looking to buy sex, where are you gonna go? You're either gonna go to Craigslist or on Backpage. That's kind of how Johns think. And so there are some people saying we need to shut down those avenues to deny Johns these easy access mechanisms, because there's a lot of Johns who probably wouldn't be willing to go trolling around on some much more explicit sex site. They're willing to be on the site as long as it looks like a legit classified page site, so there isn't like naked pictures popping up all over the place and, you know, very graphic genitalia or whatever else. But as long as it looks like a Craigslist page, they're willing to be on the page. And I think there's probably a lot of Johns that wouldn't really be willing to go beyond Craigslist and Backpage. So folks in the field are saying, if we can get Craigslist to eliminate their adult section and Backpage to eliminate their adult section, we've really denied Johns a lot of options. And there are a lot of Johns that would just kind of shrug their shoulders and be like, I'd still conceptually be willing to pay for sex, I'm just not willing to go through the trouble to find it. And they would stop there, okay? So there's kind of an online game that's happening. There is a faith community game that's happening, where there are different groups starting to talk about this in their churches. And there are pastors preaching about it from their sermons and different things. There are men's groups starting in faith communities. I met with a pastor in Texas who wanted to start this whole ministry around this and getting men to kind of talk about this in a private setting where they wouldn't feel shamed or they wouldn't feel, you know, people pointing fingers at them, but they would feel embraced and be like, yeah, I feel awful that I did this and I never want to do it again. So there's kind of a faith community aspect of it. There certainly is a law enforcement element of this, which is reminding ourselves, regardless of what you think about that debate that I was telling you earlier, in the United States, buying sex is illegal in pretty much 99% of the United States, except for 10 counties in Nevada, which are the rural counties outside of Las Vegas. So the laws of the United States have kind of spoken about this. And in all those places, buying sex is a crime. And so a lot of people say, well, why do we have to rehash this discussion again? It's already a crime. All we have to do is get law enforcement to start enforcing the law that's already there and putting Johns in jail or putting Johns in different places. And so they feel like, from a law enforcement perspective, there's a way to scare a lot of Johns. And the reason that a lot of Johns are buying sex is because they don't sense any risk to it. they feel like law enforcement's going to be like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, good old boys network, go home, you know, so, like, I'll just let you go on this one. And so if there's more of a law enforcement deterrence cracking down on Johns, there might be people who are like, all right, well, there are less Johns willing to buy because they feel this sense of fear of law enforcement. So maybe there's a law enforcement angle to do something on it. There's a John education element that's happening, which is really interesting, where different communities are experimenting with this thing called a John school. Maybe you've heard of it. Some of you probably have, some of you haven't. What it basically is it's a diversion option for men who buy sex to give them a chance to get the charge wiped off their record if they attend an 8-hour class to teach them about the harms of buying sex. So it's the equivalent of defensive driving, where you get caught speeding, you feel bad that it's on your record because it's jacking up your insurance prices, and so you say, can I go to this 8-hour Saturday class? And if I sit through about defensive driving or whatever else, you'll wipe that charge off my record so it doesn't look like I ever sped before. It's that same exact concept. So what it is there are these John schools getting launched. The first one was launched in Minnesota back in the early 80s. And then there was one launched in San Francisco in 1995. And there's a handful of others around the country where what they do is they find a guy who's bought sex and they say to him, if this was your first time ever buying sex, we're going to kind of give you the rookie mistake. You know, it was your first time, so we're going to let you go to this one-day class. And if you sit through the one-day class and you stay clean and don't buy sex for another year, at the year anniversary of the day that you bought sex, that charge will get wiped off your record. And so the John School basically... it's usually a collaboration between the police department, the district attorney's office, and a nonprofit. And it's usually like a Saturday class. And it looks exactly like this audience, except for imagine this audience being full of men who have all bought sex, which is a pretty intimidating audience. It's like a bunch of dudes sitting there. And I have the privilege of sitting and teaching at the John School in Washington, D.C. So it'll be an audience just like this. And I know that everybody in that audience has attempted to buy sex, and it's just a chance to talk to them. And usually there's about 6 or 7 different speakers because it's an 8-hour class. So the first speaker talks about public health and buying sex and how it impacts the public health. The next speaker talks about the laws and what is actually the penalty for buying sex. The next speaker talks about what does a court case usually look like for buying sex and what are the conviction rates. The next speaker is usually a survivor who's been in prostitution herself, and she speaks to the Johns directly about what it feels like to be in prostitution. The next speaker is usually a human trafficking speaker that talks about how the market for buying sex usually drives the market for sex trafficking. Sometimes there's a speaker that talks, who's a recovered John himself, and he's like, yo, guys, I used to be just like you. I used to be sitting in that chair, but then I quit buying sex, and look what happened to my life, and all this stuff. So he's kind of like a recovered John. And then there's usually a speaker who talks about sex addiction and talks about, you know, how often do you think about buying sex? How often do you stare at porn? How often do you, you know, find yourself not being productive at work because you're so focused on sex? All this stuff, right? So you have these John schools. I think there's about 50 of them around the country. And the Johns usually have to pay a fine to go to the John school. So in some cities, it's $100. In some cities, it's $500. In some cities, it's about $1,000. So the Johns have to pay this fine. And then the fine goes into a pot of money that then goes back to pay for the police department and the district attorney's office and the nonprofit. So it's kind of like this restorative justice type model. So imagine, like, for example, in D.C., the fine's $500. And let's say there's 100 Johns per month that get arrested buying sex in D.C. There's $50,000 per class. So if you do 12 of those classes, you make $600,000 a year. And that money could then be used to pay for more police officers and pay for more district attorneys and pay a nonprofit to help keep its doors open. So you have these John schools. There are other John schools that have put a little tweak on the model where they say, you buy sex, you have to attend John school and pay the fine, and sorry, you don't ever get the charge wiped off your record. It's actually a condition of your charge. So it's not an either or, it's an and. Charge plus John school. So that's out there. So you have these law enforcement mechanisms that are trying to crack down. There's other folks that are trying kind of new things. Some folks are saying, all right, well, let's suspend John's licenses, where you get caught buying sex, you get your license suspended for 6 months, and try to explain that to people about, you know, how do you get around? So folks are actually trying that. There are other folks that are trying to impound John's cars, where they're like, you bought sex, you get your car impounded. And you want to get your car out of the impound lot, it's going to cost you $1,500 or whatever else. So there are these things. There are public service announcements that are out there. The mayor of Atlanta, who used to be the mayor, Shirley Franklin, she did this whole campaign called Dear John. And she did this PSA where she's like staring into the video angrily, and she says, Dear John, you're buying sex in our community. You're making Atlanta a hub for sex trafficking. I'm not going to stand for it. Your time of buying sex without any punishment is over. You better fear my administration because we're coming after you, blah, 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 blah. And that aired on YouTube and whatever else. So if you want to see it, go to YouTube and type in Dear John campaign, and you could see all those videos. So there's videos happening. There's PSAs happening. Some folks are trying to come and take a prevention perspective where they're working with young boys who are age 8, 10, 12, 15, and trying to raise a generation of boys who grow up thinking that it's not okay to buy sex. And so sometimes they do that on their own, where it's just solely a discussion about buying sex. Sometimes they piggyback on another discussion with young boys about domestic violence and sexual assault and date rape, and they package it all together, and they talk about what date rape is, and they talk about what no means no is, and they talk about all that stuff, and then they tack on a discussion about buying sex. So there's a whole discussion to be had there about educating and working with young boys. Other folks are taking a technology approach to this, where they are trying to... And there's been some innovative ideas out there where you put a decoy ad on one of these sites like Craigslist or Backpage that says, hot young girl, click here. And then you click there, and the page that it takes you to is not a page demonstrating a hot young girl. It's a page with a big police badge that says, Dear John, you have just tried to click on our decoy ad. Please know that the Scottsdale Police Department takes this crime very seriously. We are going to be ramping up our efforts on arresting Johns in this community. Please know that we have undercover operations happening right now who are clicking on our decoy ad and not getting this badge, but are getting actually the undercover officer. Please also know that by clicking on this ad, we've actually just logged your IP address, and we know exactly where you are and what computer you're sitting at. And here's a little Google map that shows you with a little blinking red dot on where your computer is. And the John is like, oh my God, that's my street. And they know that. And then they say, we can now follow your web traffic of every traffic that you go to because we've logged your IP address. So there's some technology initiatives that are scaring the bejesus out of some Johns. So there's some interesting things being tried. And the last thing that I'll throw out there is two more things. One is this idea of shaming. Some people really like it, some people really don't. But it's this notion of shaming Johns who buy sex, where you put their faces on the front page of the newspaper and you say, these are the 10 guys that tried to buy sex last night. And it's these like 10 mug shots, and there's like, you know, and so it's this shaming element. There are some cities that have put all the Johns' faces up on a website. There are some cities that make the Johns do community service hours and wear like a big triangle table tent that says, I bought sex. You know, there's this kind of, it's this like tar and feather approach. So there's some shaming out there. And some people think that it's hilarious. Some people think that it's awful. So the shaming discussion is a discussion to have. And then the last discussion that I talk about is some people are trying to combat this from a policy perspective, where they're trying to pass state bills that make it much harder for men to buy sex. In some communities, it's a misdemeanor to buy sex. It's like a parking ticket, where if you get caught buying sex, you get written a little administrative ticket, and it's like, here's your ticket, pay your fine, mail it in, you know, whatever else. And so they're saying, you know, let's make this from a Class C misdemeanor to a Class B misdemeanor, or let's make it a felony. And so they're trying to change the actual crime of buying sex to make it more stringent. Or they're saying the penalties for buying sex used to be, you know, 7 days in jail and a $100 fine. Now we're going to make it 6 months in jail and a $2,000 fine. Or they're trying to beef up the penalties. There are some folks that they kind of feel like if there's so much debate about men buying sex from adults, about consenting adults and whatever else, why don't we start at a place that we all agree with and start at men buying sex with children? And we could really beef up the laws around men buying sex with children without even getting into this big debate about adults. Because even the keep the Johns going so they're a sex work crowd probably doesn't agree with the children element. So we could create some laws that make it much harder for if a man is ever caught buying sex with a child, the penalties are much higher, much more stringent. So there's two types of laws in that front that I talk about. One is the law that was just passed in Washington State called the commercial sex abuse of a minor, which is you just had sex with a minor and paid her for sex. So it's kind of like statutory rape plus money. And so your penalty should be just like the penalty for statutory rape. So it's a many more years in jail, much higher fine. But it actually requires the sex act to occur. And it's kind of after the sex act happened, there's a much higher penalty. There's another type of law that's before the sex act even occurs, which focuses on the sexual solicitation of a minor, where you're just soliciting the minor for sex and then verbally agreeing, okay, so we're going to have sex for $40, right? And then that verbal agreement constitutes the crime, even if you don't ever go through with it. And so when the sexual solicitation of a minor crimes get passed, it enables law enforcement to do lots more things without the Sex Act ever occurring. So Maryland, the state of Maryland, just passed a law about the sexual solicitation of a minor. And then what they did is they started doing undercover stings of Johns who are attempting to buy sex from a minor. So the police department put up a fake decoy ad of a young-looking girl, like they found someone's high school yearbook photo or whatever else, and put it up online and said, come buy sex from Sally. And all these guys started clicking on the ad, and they said, you know, if you want to buy sex from Sally, call this number. So the John's calling the number, and it's the police department on the other end of the phone answering and acting like they are a pimp. And being like, oh, well, where do you want to meet? Here's the cost. You know, just want to make sure, like, you're not the police, right? You know, like, going through all that stuff. And then they say during the course of the conversation, by the way, you know, just between you and me, just want to let you know she's 15. And just want to make sure you're cool with that. And the John's like, all right, thanks for letting me know. And then they're like, okay, if you want to go through with it, it'll be $80. And he's like, okay, where do I go? And so he's fully intending to go through with it. And if this weren't the police, if this were a pimp, he would have gone through with it. And then the police meet him at the predetermined location at some house or some parking lot or whatever else, and he shows up and he's like, hey, is this so-and-so? Is this the place where I come have sex with Sally, the 15-year-old, for $80? And they're like, yeah, this is the place. And they put handcuffs on him, and there was no minor ever. And so you're able to do the enforcement without any minor being involved, and then you could catch a bunch of Johns that way and charge them with the crime of sexual solicitation of a minor. So that was something that was attempted in Maryland. They did it a couple weeks ago, and they wound up arresting 15 guys in one night. And one of the guys turned out to be the chief of staff of one of the major congressmen in D.C. And he got fired that day, where they were like, dude, you're out trying to buy sex from a minor. Like, what? And he lost his job, and that was a senior chief of staff. Probably a 30-year political career ended. So whether or not it's the law enforcement angle the young boys angle, the policy angle, the faith angle, the John education angle, the shaming angle, the let's only talk about minors angle because we could all agree there, the research angle. All those different things are beginning to be brainstormed and beginning to be thought through. But like I said, it's all new. It's going to be a long, long road. Like people talked about the long defeat. It's going to be a long defeat. I doubt that any of this will change in decades. So if people are going to start this discussion, we're going to be having it 30, 40 years from now, and we have to be prepared for that. There's going to be some serious opposition, and it's going to be contentious and very controversial, is my guess. And it's really a blank slate right now in terms of what's going to happen in the field and what's going to happen in the space. But more and more people are increasingly coming to the conclusion that if sex traffickers go wherever there are men buying sex, how do we ever get rid of sex trafficking if there are still men buying sex? All right, well, let me open it up for questions there. And why don't we start with yours? But let's open it up for questions. That's everything I want to say by means of introduction. We have about 20 minutes left, so we'll do 20 minutes of questions. I'll try to answer quickly so we could get as many questions as possible. But I'd encourage you all to start just thinking through this and see what you feel about it. Just try it on for size. Let's start with you. Yeah. Creating a pill that reduces male libido. I mean, we're in the stage of people brainstorming anything right now, so. Potentially. Yes, ma'am. His question was, should we have some sort of pill that is given to men after they buy sex that reduces their libido, so it's like a medical reduction of the likelihood that they'd ever do it again. Yes, ma'am. Great question. There are folks that are trying to convince media to come out and do more that would stigmatize buying sex through the media. And there are folks that are trying to talk to the media about what is their role in the sexualization of young girls, like running stories about girls gone wild and Hooters and, you know, whatever else. Like how do we change that? And so I don't think there's ever been many major media stories about it, but just the behind-the-scenes discussions are starting. I would really encourage you all to watch the CNN piece this Sunday at 5 o'clock Pacific. I think it's going to be powerful, and it talks to a lot of Johns. And it talks to Johns at a John school, and it talks to Johns who have bought sex from minors. So it'll be one of the first media pieces that really try to start stigmatizing this. So I think it's starting, but I think it's a great angle, and it needs a lot more work. The pornography angle is even a bigger discussion, but a huge driver of it. Yes, ma'am. Sure. Yeah, I think it's a good question. For those who didn't hear the question was about advertising and the objectification of women. I think that all of these ideas are good ideas. I think that where the discussion is going to occur is maybe we can crack down on the advertisers of those who are blatantly advertising for prostitution. Like if you go in the back of certain magazines, like if you go in the back of the SF Weekly, or if you go in the back of different things, it's pretty blatant that there's a bunch of sex ads. And those advertisers are making money from those sex ads because they're not free. You have to pay to put those postings. So I think we could probably say these are advertising for a crime, and we could start there. And I think there'd probably be some more agreement there. I think if we start getting into the broader thing about, you know, what does it mean to be a cheerleader and is that kind of objectifying women or whatever else, that'll probably be a longer discussion to have because there's so many widely divergent opinions there. But starting with just straight advertising for prostitution that has crept into so many of our major newspapers and major media outlets, I think is a great place to start. And if you all, I know Betty Ann keeps talking about this is a conference of action. One of the things that I would recommend you all do is any single literary paper that you read, if you read the San Francisco Chronicle, if you read the SF Weekly, if you read the San Jose Mercury News, whatever thing that you read, I would flip through it and see if there's any sex ads. And in New York, the Village Voice has so many sex ads on the back three pages, it's ridiculous. And the Washingtonian Magazine, which we read in Washington, D.C., has a bunch of sex ads in the back. And so there's different folks around the country who are doing campaigns against newspapers to say, quit advertising for sex ads and quit taking revenue from sex ads, because either just by nature of them being a sex ad or because they might be human trafficking. And the Washington Post, for example, used to advertise for Asian brothels every day in the sports section. And it turned out that a lot of those places that they were advertising for were later raided by the federal authorities and found out that it was human trafficking. So the Washington Post was profiting off of sex slavery. And there was a big campaign that Polaris and others did where we met with Washington Post executives and said, you are literally advertising off the rape for profit of these girls. And for a while they held out, and then just about 3 months ago they made the decision to quit advertising all commercial sex ads for these massage parlors that were likely human trafficking in their sports pages. So they're gone. So take a look at that, and you might find a target of a local campaign that you want to do. Go to change.org and start a petition and start a campaign and go from there. Yes, sir. I'm not. I've heard people talk about it. Like, for example, let's say 50 of us decided to go stand in front of the door of a massage parlor. And we just stood there, and any guy that tried to walk in, we just shouted at him and did whatever else. I bet we could probably turn away 90% of the customers. Some people think that that's a good idea. Other people think that it might be misconstrued as stigmatizing the women inside, where it would make the women feel even more ashamed that they're in the sex industry because they're like, look at all these people protesting me. And so some people don't want to do it because they don't want it to backfire and make the women's self-esteem go even lower. Some people think it might be dangerous because a John might get hostile and be like, you know, and punch you on the way in. So they don't want to do it because of the danger factor. Other people are thinking through the legality of blocking someone's business like that. But my guess is if you stand far away from the door, like protesting could be allowed. So people are brainstorming different things like that. I have heard that idea, yeah. Good Lord. Yes, ma'am.
Can you speak to the effectiveness of a John's school? Because I recently watched a documentary called Very Young Girls, and they showed a portion of it where it showed a John's school, and the Johns were just heckling the teachers.
Yeah, I agree. Very Young Girls is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, I'd recommend you all watch it. It was a movie that was put out by an organization called GEMS in New York City. It's on Netflix. It's instant play on Netflix. You could also buy it from GEMS. Polaris partnered with GEMS on that film and gave them some of our footage. But yeah, there's a really powerful scene in there of a John school where this district attorney clearly doesn't look very excited to be there. And she's kind of rolling her eyes and kind of laughing with the Johns. And like, let's all not take this very seriously. And she's like, look, y'all, you know, you don't want to be out there buying sex from the girl because she's probably a girl and she's probably been arrested like 30 times. And so why would you want to do that? And the guy kind of raises his hand. He goes, excuse me, when's the break? Like they like clearly just didn't care. I do think John's schools widely range, but there was a really intensive evaluation of the San Francisco John School. And the researcher that did it is a guy by the name of Michael Shively, and his last name, S-H-I-V-E-L-Y. And if you look up Shively evaluation of John School, you could read his whole study, but he actually found, surprisingly enough, that the John School really did have a statistically significant impact in reducing the number of Johns who purchased prostitution. And I could say from speaking at the DC John School, just based on my own gut, like not necessarily what a research study tells me, but based on my own gut, I would say that there's kind of three populations of men in the John School. One is men who everything you say just hits them like a brick wall and rolls off. Like they're gonna go buy sex that night and they don't care and they think that you're just like a man-hating liberal and they just kind of laugh at you and they're just like, please, you know, I'll do what I want, shut up. And like they're like in total denial and that's where they are. Then there's a second population who are kind of like middle of the road and they're kind of like open and they're kind of puzzled and you could tell the wheels are turning but you're quite not quite sure how it's impacting them. And then there's a third population of guys who, like, you could just see it in their face. You could see it in their eyes. You could see the light bulbs going off. You could see the remorse. And they come up to you afterwards, and in a very genuine way, which I don't think they're faking it, in a very genuine way, they're like, I feel absolutely awful. Like, I had never thought of it like that. And I never thought of it from her perspective. And I never thought of how many guys she had to be with every day. And I never thought of how, you know, ashamed she might have felt. And I never thought that I would ever be contributing to the sex trafficking market. And the thought that the fact that I was buying sex might have made some pimp try to pimp out a girl. And I just feel awful about myself. And I swear to you, I will never do this again. And they literally walk out of there like a changed guy. And so I think it's a mixed bag. But I would check out Shively's study because he did find that they have an impact. Let's go way in the back to, yes. Yeah, I think that because I don't agree or necessarily understand how to make that argument, I probably can't explain what's behind it. My best sense is there's probably a belief in that argument that buying and selling sex should not be illegal and that it should be legal because it's an act between two consenting adults and should be heavily regulated so that, you know, we would live in a world where, you know, at the strip mall down the street, you know, there's a nail salon, there's a Fuddruckers, there's a sports bar, and then there's a brothel. And we would all know that there's a brothel there, and it would be legal to be there, like Amsterdam or whatever else. And then when you went in there, you can be guaranteed that the women are being tested for STDs, and that the women are being tested to make sure they don't have a pimp, and to make sure that they're keeping their wages, and to make sure that it's kind of a dignified job, and the men would be screened and whatever else. And so brothels would become part of the fabric of society instead of being kind of like shoved into the shadows and shoved into dark alleyways. It would be kind of like normalized as part of society, and therefore less dangerous, less dirty, less likelihood of sexual assault. There would be like a panic button in the brothel, so if the woman's being raped, she could hit the button and the police would come in 10 minutes. Like, there's all those different types of things. We are envisioning a different world where you're not viewing sex as this illegal thing. So you're fighting for sex to be work, which is why you use the word sex work, because you think that it should be work as regulated just like farm work and domestic work and whatever else. And so you want to see that industry be embraced as work. So there's probably a whole concern around it being illegal in the first place. And I just, in being in the field for the past 8 years, you try to model a certain ethic in the field. Like, you try to be respectful, you try to be open, you try to be friendly, you try to embrace folks, you try to find areas of common ground, and I really try to walk that walk. But I think in this particular debate of, is buying sex feeding sex trafficking, or is buying sex something that we should try to be the incomes of sex workers, I haven't yet found that common ground yet, and I'm still trying to find it, because right now I think they're pretty fighting for the opposite things. Yes, sir. Question about sex tourism? International sex tourism. Yeah, so there's just an industry out there. It's euphemistically dubbed sex tourism, where you go on a tour of a other country specifically for the purpose of having sex with that country's women. Like, you're sampling the local goods, you're sampling the local food, you're sampling the local women. And so sometimes sex tourism is arranged for adults, where it's like, we'll take you on a sex tour, you know, we'll arrange your hotel for you, we'll arrange your plane fare for you, we'll, you know, get a taxi driver for you, and we'll give you kind of a brothel map, and we'll get you all lined up with all the, you know, all the brothels, so you don't have to go hunting for them, and all you have to do is say yes and pay $2,000, and you'll have your plane fare and your and everything, and you just kind of go and, you know, have as much sex as you want. And so that could either be for adults. Sometimes there's child sex tourism, where that whole thing is specifically arranged for having sex with children. Same thing, we'll pay for your visa, your flight, your hotel. We'll line up all the brothels where there are children, so we'll do all that pre-front due diligence for you so you don't have to go hunting for it. We'll help you evade law enforcement, because what you're about to do is child rape, and arrange it. So there's an effort to kind of crack down on both adult sex tourism and child sex tourism in one viewpoint. In the other viewpoint, maybe sex tourism is helping people's income. And so there's kind of that split. But yeah, there are some efforts specifically to fight against child sex tourism. Yeah. I don't know as much about it, quite frankly. Just don't know as much about it. I know that it's a part of the sex industry that I've spent most of my time working on the females in prostitution and less on the men. I've met a couple of guys. I spent last weekend with a guy who was in the sex trade as a boy, who had run away from home, and he and I were talking, and he was talking about how, you know, all these older pedophiles would come and pay him to stay at their house and say, you know, hey, you're homeless, you're 9 years old, you know, I'll give you shelter and food and give you a place to stay if you stay at my house and let me provide oral sex to you daily or something like that. And this boy was so desperate, he's like, sure, I need a place to stay. And he would go through with that. And he talked about how he knew a bunch of other boys that were in that situation. And some boys stayed there, some boys left, some boys, you know, felt exploited, others didn't. You know, that's all kind of range. And he was just describing it to me, and I feel like you're totally right. It's not as much part of the dialogue. And I think if we're going to do a broader campaign on demand, there needs to be a part of that campaign that talks about the demand for sex with young boys from certain pedophiles. But I think that, because it's not necessarily representative of the majority of the sex trade, the majority of the sex trade tends to be women and girls in the sex trade. And so that's kind of where most discussions tend to go. I'm totally not going to get to everyone's questions, but I'll try to get to a few more. Yeah.
Society. Mm-hmm. So, like, how do we compare it to society today?
I don't know. I think it's a great question. I really don't know. I wish I knew.
It's a very unfortunate trend in society. Mm-hmm.
I think it is getting more normalized, but I think that you're right. There are certain cultural scripts that it's just kind of like built into the cultural script. Like if you're having a bachelor party, you should have a stripper. Like that's the cultural script. I think it's ridiculous, but that's the script that people feel like, dude, you're having a bachelor party and you don't have a stripper? Like what kind of lame party are you having? A bunch of guys like sitting around sharing their feelings? That's ridiculous. So like, you know what I mean? Like. So I think that like that same cultural norm of, you know, you gotta buy sex is built into different things. Like in the Japanese geisha culture, where you went to a geisha house to hang out with your male buddies, there were just these female geisha sitting around, like pouring drinks for you and kissing your neck and letting you rub their leg and stuff like that. And the industry of hostess clubs is basically the same thing, where it's an industry catering towards men who want to go hang out there with other men, but you want to watch sports and you want to, you know, drink a beer with your buddy or whatever else, but you just think it would be funner if there are these like attractive women sitting on your laps. So these like hostess clubs have popped up, which exist in plenty of different cultures. So there are these scripts, and I think as long as one of those scripts gets locked in, it makes buying sex normalized and then even harder to fight against. Totally. Let's do one more question and then I'm going to be, yes, woman is jumping out of her seat. Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay, well, his question was about scripts of buying sex and historically what other cultures have done that. Yeah?
Just in response to this question, there's a book called Human Trafficking by Louise Shelley. They did 15 years of research on it. And it said that different cultures have different patterns that work in consumer society, and so it's become more appropriate as consumers to be entitled. And it talks about all of the different continents and their historical patterns and how it's changed.
Interesting. So a book called Human Trafficking by Louise Shelley. Let's do one more and then we'll wrap. Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. I definitely agree. I hope y'all heard that. All right, well, why don't we wrap up from there? I know there's a bunch of questions that we didn't get to, so if you have questions that we didn't get to, I'll be up here chatting, so feel free to come on up. I hope that was educational for you all. I hope you got something out of it. Thanks for coming.